Ed Harrison here for Real Vision. I am talking to Matt Cadner, a portfolio manager at GMO. He's also a senior member of their asset allocation team. Matt, welcome to Real Vision.
Thanks, Ed. Great to be with you.
You know, you are the third person from GMO who we've spoken to over the last year. We spoke to Jeremy Grantham. I spoke to Ben Inker, and now I have the pleasure of speaking to you. Your company has a storied history of really getting markets right, particularly the internet bubble. And also, I would say that you also got the housing bubble very right as well.
Yeah, it's, it's a wonderful place steeped in tradition. There's a lot of really smart people, really good people. And it's really been a fantastic place. I've been there almost 16 years. It's been a fantastic place to learn and grow over that time period. And certainly working with Jeremy and Ben all these years has been fantastic as well.
Yeah. And, you know, actually, right before this interview, I was looking at one of my old friend Barry Ritholtz's commentaries, and he had you for his masterclass interview up at your offices in Boston. This was in 2018. The first thing that caught my eye was that, you know, Barry, as a lawyer, he was talking to you about the law and how, and, you know, actually I worked as a paralegal way long ago, and how
sorry
you
to hear that.
Felt like it was just a miserable life, and you moved into the wonderful world of finance. Talk to me a little bit about that before we get into your views on what's happening today.
Yeah, sure. So I was toiling away as an attorney here in Boston. I was doing a lot of medical malpractice defense. So working for, you know, the Harvard hospitals or New England Medical Center hospitals. And it was really miserable because it's definitely brass knuckle type litigation. And it's very emotional because, you know, people were either hurt or they, you know, somebody had died and you're talking to their relatives. And so it was really a pretty miserable existence for a young associate that wasn't really someone who wanted to kind of get in there and fight all the time. And I ended up being able to make a transition from the med mal defense work to working at a broker dealer. So I worked at LPL Financial Services in their legal office for a couple years. And I thought, oh, it's good. I'm going to move into finance. I was a finance undergrad major. And so it'll be a lot more staid. It'll be a lot less emotional. It'll be great. And what I realized is that people care as much about their financial health as they do their health. And so the emotions were definitely part of that as well. And then you also had to deal with responding to the government and the government subpoenas and investigations. And so that was pretty miserable as well. And so my father-in-law gave me a book. And that book was What Color Is Your Parachute? And he knew I was pretty miserable. And he said, hey, kid, you know, what he had learned when, you know, he was young is if you enjoy what you're doing, you never work a day in your life. And so I was trying to figure out what I would enjoy doing. And so this book, What Color Is Your Parachute, got me to understand what I enjoyed doing was finance. And I also enjoyed communicating and talking to people. And so I was able to finagle a job at Putnam right before the internet bubble popped, working in their institutional sales team. And that was just such a breath of fresh air versus the legal world and the antagonism of the legal world, that it was just so fun that I could, you know, what I enjoyed doing, what I enjoyed reading about was something that I could get paid for. And so that really was the transition. And I used to see people that I, you know, you would have cases against or practice with, and they would say, like, you know, where have you been? I said, oh, well, I've changed careers. And invariably the response was some form of, oh, you got out, as if you've escaped from Stalag 13. And so it's really been a ton of fun ever since.
Yeah, that is a great story, I have to say. And, you know, the interesting bit about your conversation with Barry Ritholtz, I noticed that it was from 2018. That was the date. And immediately I thought to what's actually happening in the markets, because you and I, we spoke a month ago in preparation for this, but there's been a long lead time between when we spoke and now. And the markets today, a month later, look a lot more like the markets of early 2018 than they did a month ago. So I want to talk to you about, to a certain degree, about what I spoke to Ben about, but then deep dive into asset allocation. But I want to talk to you as well about what's actually happening in the markets today. Let me preface it by saying, so, you know, when I spoke to Ben, we were talking about the 60-40 portfolio. And basically, when we were thinking about bonds, we were thinking about bonds being able to protect you against drawdowns in equities. We were thinking about bonds as providing you income. And we were thinking about bonds in a worst case scenario in terms of their inflation protection or inflation hurting bonds. Those are the three categories that I'm most interested in. And originally, I wanted to focus on the first two, but now it seems like the third, that inflation part, the negative impact on bonds is the part that people are thinking about right now. So how are you and GMO thinking about inflation and bonds actually increasing in yield right now?
Yeah, you know, it seems as though the world has awoken to the fact that there is a potential risk of inflation out there, that maybe 70 basis points on a 10-year didn't really reflect some of that downside risk associated with inflation. I do think that we have a bit of skepticism with respect to kind of a full-throated return of inflation similar to what we saw in the 1970s, which is what everybody's concern was, right? You know, you had inflation, you know, averaging 6 or 7% during that decade. You had a couple of years where inflation was at 11%. That inflation had seeped into wages. You had this wage price spiral. And it was a pretty miserable decade for stocks and bonds. And so today, the likelihood of that wage price spiral being triggered, which is really what you need given costs, wages are 70% of the corporate cost structure, you know, you really need inflation to seep into wages in order to have that type of outcome. And I think we're skeptical, particularly, you know, we're still 9 million jobs short of where we were pre-pandemic, that likelihood is something that is on the offing. But you can get these cyclical bouts of inflation that can be pretty painful at times, right? If you're used to a inflationary environment of 1-2% and all of a sudden inflation is 3-4%, you know, that's going to feel pretty dramatically worse than it would just if you were used to that higher inflation environment. And so I think that's kind of the shorter term concerns with respect to inflation. What I think we worry about more from an intermediate to longer term concern with respect to inflation is the risk of a policy mistake. So you have a lot of stimulus coming into the pipeline again this year, and the growth of MMT as an economic philosophy and an excuse for governors, government writ large, to spend more money. And we know that if you're elected official, spending money is a lot more fun than taking funds away. And so we do worry that you have a mistake with respect to the timing of that fiscal policy when the economy is likely running at close to full potential, and that fiscal stimulus continues, and that potentially has the risk of being much more inflationary than some of these cyclical bouts that we may be seeing right now.
Right. And, you know, I think two things on that. One, we can go back to that environment. What does that mean for equities as well as for bonds? But I want to come back to that. But I want to ask a question about Walmart in particular and, you know, cost push inflation or whatever they used to call it in the 70s, because they came out with this whole thing saying we're going to take 425,000 workers and we're going to pay them more. The Biden administration, they've come out with this deal where they want to push for 15% minimum wage, which is a lot higher than their current minimum wage. Isn't that potentially the impetus that you could get for cost push inflation, where, you know, you see this whole inflation going into wages? Do you think that is a potential place where your skepticism would start to wane?
I think that's certainly a potential. You know, the ultimate question there is what happens to profit margins. So how much of that wage pressure gets pushed on? I mean, there is an aspect of that I would say hallelujah, in that, you know, real wages for the past 40 or 50 years in the United States haven't moved. And that has been really the source of this increasing income inequality, which really has long-term pernicious impacts on the overall economy. But I think it's going to take a little bit more. You're going to start to need to see that on a much more broad-based scale versus a handful, even Walmart, which is a pretty big company. And you're going to need to see that on a much broader base scale in order to really worry about that cost push inflation.
Right. And now let's say that this environment of not cost push, but rather where we have on the one hand, cyclical bouts of inflation, but relatively moderate inflation, but inflation that on average is slightly higher than it had been before. What kind of environment is that for investing, both in terms of bonds and equities, potentially in a 60-40 portfolio?
Well, it feels like that's the type of environment where you're going to see a larger risk premium, both on the equity and the bond side. And so one thing that we know investors don't like is uncertainty. And so if you have uncertainty with respect to the economy or uncertainty with respect to inflation, you know, that is going to impact PE multiples. That's going to impact a real bond yields and what investors are going to demand. And so that type of environment seems to be quite different from the environment that we've experienced over, you know, certainly the last 5 to 7 years, save a little bit of 2020. And that environment, and you would expect to see your PEs contract within the equity market, that bond yields in that type of environment should be increasing, whether or not they stop at 135 or 150 or get back to something like 2 or 3 like we had a couple of years ago. It's a function of how violent the move is. But it certainly would argue for a resetting in the tone of risk, certainly versus what we've seen more recently, particularly with respect to equities.
And, you know, interestingly, that sort of dovetails with something that you told me when we spoke a month ago, and you were talking about some forecasting that you did. You know, there's the so-called hell forecast, and then there's the purgatory forecast. And, you know, in the hell forecast, I'm just looking at this. You had secular stagnation, which is what you can talk to. And then I'm looking at my notes saying that the purgatory forecast had the equity risk premium falling to 4.5% real instead of 6%. Talk to me about how you guys, the method to your madness at GMO in terms of forecasting, in terms of longer term asset allocation thinking.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been doing asset allocation actually started back in 1987 at GMO. And the 7-year asset class forecasts have been the primary input to that asset allocation framework, you know, going back. The forecast formally started back in 1994. And the assumptions to the forecast are pretty simple. They had assumed that whatever valuation you're trading at, whatever PEs and margins are today, they're going to mean revert to what we call normal levels through time. And a normal level is really a function of history, as well as our judgment as to whether or not something has changed. And we recognize that things change pretty slowly when you're talking about things like PEs and margins. The equilibrium rates are pretty static through time, although they do change. And part of the risk management is trying to understand, you know, where it may be different this time. And so in that risk management framework, the idea of like, well, what happens if your discount rates are going to be suppressed for long enough that changes the equilibrium valuation that investors are willing to pay to own certain assets. And so that was originally dubbed a hell scenario, because that means your longer term equilibrium returns for stocks and bonds are falling. and your ability to generate five real without leverage, it really goes out the window. And so everybody's asset allocation kind of blows up at that standpoint. So your endowment trying to make five real, you're trying to make five real for retirement, you just can't get there from here. So we came up with this alternative scenarios. And so we've kind of, we called it hell at the time. We've remarketed as partial mean reversion, which hopefully is a bit more intuitive. But instead of stocks mean reverting to a 16 PE, they're going to mean revert to a 20 PE. And instead of bond yields going back to 4.8 on a nominal 10-year in the US, they're going to go back to something like 3.6 on a nominal 10-year. That's equilibrium. And the basis here is that real cash yields are going to be zero. So your equity risk premium and your bond risk premium all reset lower because there's the risk-free rate in real terms is going to be zero going forward. And so that was very much a secular stagnation type argument. And it allowed us to think about the trade-offs between the two scenarios. It allowed us to address a lot of client concerns about the impact of the low rates. And we felt like it gave us a better guide in assessing returns over our 7-year horizon, which is our prediction period. And so we, you know, there's no quantitative way to balance those. There's no model that you can use to optimize in order to get the right weighting. And so we started with a 1/3 partial mean reversion, 2/3 normal mean reversion scenario. And that, by the way, what was a pretty big concession for us. Like if there was a mean reversion society, you know, we would have been card carrying kind of founding members, if you were, but we did recognize that something might be different here. And then a couple of years ago, we did reduce those odds to 50-50 given what we were seeing in productivity and demographic growth. And so we've kind of been at that weight for, you know, probably the past couple of years in terms of balancing those two competing scenarios.
Right. Very interesting. And what in terms of the 60-40 portfolio, let's go macro here. What does that mean in terms of the death of 60-40? And I'll preface my question or your answer by saying that what we saw in the drawdown in March of 2020 is that 60-40 didn't really work at that particular juncture. Great that we're 75% up on the S&P since that time. However, if drawdowns of 30% remain for an extended period of time, what we saw back then was actually with rates as low as they are, they didn't provide very much cushion against that drawdown from the equity side of the portfolio. So 60-40 is difficult in that circumstance.
Yeah, it just doesn't give you the cushion that it once did. You know, bonds have been a fantastic disinflationary, deflationary hedge over the past 4 or 5 crises. And so we saw bonds did, you know, they acted admirably in the US in March of last year. And so actually a US-based 60-40 investor, which has its duration from US rates, actually fared much better than if you were a European or a Swiss investor where actually rates went up in March. So you lost on your equities and your bonds. And so it does cause you to rethink, you know, what is 60-40 for the next generation? And now we have had bond yields come back somewhat. So there is a little bit more cushion than there was, but certainly not the cushion that we had the luxury of having bond rates at, you know, 10-year rates at 5% heading into the global financial crisis. And so the way we thought about this was, you know, you can lower your duration and you can do that in a multitude of ways in a 60-40 portfolio. But what we have really been unable to do is to find that magic asset that is going to have a positive expected return and a negative correlation to equities like bonds have provided. That in, you know, outside of high grade government bonds, you know, that combination, positive expected return and a negative correlation, is really hard to come by because everybody and their brother is going to want to get a hold of that if they can find it, because it provides such a wonderful role with respect to diversification. And I think that's the question we've asked ourselves over the past year or so with respect to high-grade government bonds.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, and you know, I'm looking and thinking back to your 2Q report, and there were three specific asset classes that you were talking about as potential replacements, in part for government bonds, and maybe we can talk through some of those. High yield, one; emerging markets is a second, and then asset backed securities. All three of which are, to a degree, replacing income that you lost in your portfolio through the suppression of rates.
Yeah, so I mean, we were offered some interesting opportunities in March of last year to not own nominal duration, but to go out the credit curve. And so as we saw spreads in high yield kind of go through 1,000, 1,100 basis points, they were discounting pretty bad scenarios with respect to defaults. We were able to allocate to high yield. We thought that was an attractive trade. Emerging debt spreads likewise had widened, and we thought that those two areas of credit looked very interesting at the time. Now, unfortunately, we've had certainly starting with the Fed bazooka or whatever they called it back in April, where they announced that they were going to be buying bonds and buying high yield. We've seen spreads come in back to levels that, frankly, we don't think are that attractive anymore. Although, interestingly, in the distressed space, we are still seeing some opportunities, particularly in COVID-related sectors and stressed performing credit. So higher grade companies that are being priced as if they're going to be impaired in some ways. And so actually on the distressed side, apart from traditional bankruptcies, we're actually seeing some interesting opportunities there. But credit spreads have come in pretty meaningfully. And so we haven't exited all of those positions, but there's just less opportunity there now given where spreads are. Asset backs are the other area that we do think is quite attractive and very interesting to us. And oftentimes when investors think of floating rate credit, they gravitate towards bank loans. And being a credit guy, Ed, I'm sure certainly you can appreciate the what has happened in the bank loan market over the past 4 or 5 years with the return of CovLite and the lending standards being deteriorated, the resulting recovery rates coming down, the liquidity of that asset class. We just don't think that that's a great source of return. And it still, to us, is a source of worry, even though you do have the Fed threatening to come in and buy bonds. But just so much of that market used to be dominated really by insurance companies who are up buy and hold. And now they're really dominated by the mutual funds and the ETFs. And that can exacerbate the price movements. But on the asset back side, you know, a lot of people still think of asset backs and think of subprime and have, you know, cast aside that asset class. But it's a pretty mature asset class because you're dealing with some structures that have been around for, you know, 5, 10 years. There's more durability to the asset class, that it's less impacted by macro events. And it's really more about your security selection within the asset class. And so whether that's RMBS, some aspects of CMBS, which is, you know, the lower quality end there can be troublesome, certainly given COVID and what companies are going to do in terms of returning to work, but also student loans, autos, credit cards, There's a lot of interesting CLOs. There's a lot of interesting areas within the asset-backed market. And it feels like a kind of forgotten, unloved asset class. And we think if you're going to get credit exposure and you're worried about the duration associated with credit, that asset backs are really a good place to be.
Yeah, the biggest interesting bit that you had in there was about the loan market. Because basically we're talking about four different markets, or you can say three if you put high yield and leveraged loans or loans in general together. I've been recycling Chuck Prince's commentary from 2007 recently, you know, where he said, you know, as long as we, you know, as long as the music's playing, we got to dance, and we're still dancing. He got pilloried for this. This is the CEO of Citibank back in 2007. And what came out subsequently in hearings before Congress is that he was talking about the leveraged loan market. And what he was saying was, we have to participate in the leveraged loan market in order to, if we want to participate at all, we've got to go in full, because if we don't, then we can't participate in that market. We can't be a player. And it's up to government to regulate that market to stop these ridiculous deals from happening. And it seems to me like that's exactly where we are again in 2021.
Yeah. And then some. And, you know, there was one of the Fed policy committees, the staff actually had a report in January talking about the concerns that they had, and they signaled out leveraged loans. But the debt levels and the financial instability that underlies all this, you know, those risks have increased, and they've talked about that risk. I've heard Kaplan from the Dallas Fed talk about those risks being increased, but it's, you know, generally speaking, everything's fine. And that's definitely not the narrative that you're seeing in markets, but the risk, those underlying risks have only accentuated in the past year.
Right. And, you know, what are the kryptonites for those particular four asset markets that we're talking about? We're talking about high yield, leveraged loans, emerging markets, and we're talking about asset-backed securities.
Well, I mean, one piece of kryptonite that you talked about recently is, right, what happens if these variants of COVID come back with a vengeance, come back more quickly than we can vaccinate, or are less resistant to, or they're more resistant to the vaccinations. And so that slowing of the economy is really the thing that can undo all this, because, you know, you still have to stay, well, maybe if you're doing pick toggle loans, you don't have to stay current. You can just issue more debt, but generally you have to repay some of this at some point. And so the economy slowing down, I think, is the thing that is really, you know, is the real risk for that.
Right. I want to get back to this concept of duration, because I'm thinking about growth companies. You know, I think I was talking to Ben Cadner, or sorry, to Ben Inker about this, Matt, and putting you guys together. And we were talking about duration. I think the thesis I had back then was talking about growth stocks as a long duration play. The way that he was talking about it, he said, wait a minute, you know, let's go through the psychology of why you're buying into these areas of the market. And ultimately he came out saying that it's not because of duration that you're buying into them. And that's a fair point. And it goes to whether or not there's froth in those markets, in equities. But at the same time, when we look at interest rates going up, which is what's happening now because of the reflation, there is a sense in which these are actually long-lived assets. These are duration assets. The FANGs, but not just the FANGs, companies like Tesla, Nikola, any of these companies where the cash flows are 5, 10, 20 years into the future. What happens in a world of this slightly higher inflation, higher real yields punctuated by bouts of inflation? How do those companies perform? And what does that mean for indices around the world, and particularly in the United States?
Well, if the narrative is that these companies benefited as rates go down, then the narrative should be that they get hurt as the rates will go up. Now, I'm sure that is a bearish narrative. So therefore there's going to be a lot of eloquent explanation as to why that is not true. But, I don't think that a lot of people think about these assets as really being long duration assets. in that, you know, if you're paying, you know, 200 times forward earnings for a stock, that, man, you have to have a very high level of growth for a very long level, very long time in order to justify those levels of valuation. It is possible, but we know that those next great companies are, you know, there's lots of next great companies, but how many great companies actually come through that? We know that they are very few and very far between. And you also have to investigate, if you do think that Tesla is going to be selling, you know, X number of millions of cars in order to justify that level of valuation, you know, one of the things is, all right, where are they going to get the raw materials to do all this? You know, we have a resources strategy, and the portfolio manager for the resource strategy talked about, well, they're going to need multiples of the nickel and lithium that is produced on an annual basis in order to meet those projections. Where is that going to come from? And so, you know, for high quality stocks that have long histories of being profitable, making good capital allocation decisions, I think that duration argument, you know, may make sense. But for what we're seeing in the market right now, software companies valued at 44 times sales, there's just the likelihood of that level of growth is just so low that it really would be different this time, that you would be able to justify a lot of the valuations that you're seeing in aspects of growth, not all parts of growth, but certainly aspects of growth.
Right. So, I mean, if I could take what you're saying, you're bifurcating or trifurcating, if you will, the world into three buckets. There's one, the is everything a bubble? Answer, yes, there are some areas of the market where there is, you know, froth that's excessive that will come undone. Then there are other companies which have stable and good cash flows now and likely will have them into the future, which could benefit from lower interest rates. And then there's a third part of the that are non-growth value equities, you know, that have good metrics in terms of both cheapness and duration. And those are three separate universes.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
5-1-0, declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, and I feel like that last universe is the universe that has, I mean, it's disappointed for so long. It's quite reasonable to question what is going on there. And we have interrogated value pretty significantly over the last several years, and a couple other, you know, some of the other kind of value managers out there have done similar things, and they've come up to similar conclusions in that we don't think that value is broken. Things are different, though. You know, growth is staying growthier longer than it has. Stocks are maintaining their growth characteristics on average about a year longer than they would normally. That's different. That's materially different than what we certainly saw in 99, 2000. But the fundamentals within value, and we can talk about how you define value, but the fundamentals within value, you know, value's growth is about the same as it has always been. And so the more than 100% of its underperformance has come from the asset class getting cheaper. And that piece, that the undergrowth of value is value because it grows less than the market, that the fact that that is normal is really an enormous piece of the puzzle, because if the growth for value would be less than what we've seen historically, then it should deserve to trade at a wider discount, but we're not seeing that. So we, you know, the term we've used is value is bruised, but it's not broken. And so, you know, whenever you have these excesses, there are other areas of the market where there are opportunities. And we think that value globally and across sectors is really attractively priced, you know, well into the top decile of you know, any which way that we can measure it.
You know, let me attack that problem from a mean reversion perspective, because I know that you were talking about being card-carrying members of the Mean Reversion Club, maybe what's happening is twofold. One is when you look at intangibles on balance sheets in terms of profit margins, that these growth companies, they have a huge amount of intangibles and therefore their profit margins are higher. And therefore, when you think about mean reversion to, we're looking at mean reversion to higher profit margins for that reason alone. But then there's secondarily what I talked to Ben about, which is this industry concentration as well. So there again, you potentially could mean revert to higher levels of profit, particularly in these growth areas where there are economies of scale, but not only that, there are network effects as well. And as a result, people are willing to pay more because they think that they can sustain these profit margins that are higher for longer than value companies.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton to unpack right there. But I'll start with one of Jeremy's quotes. He talked about when I joined GMO back in 04, you know, the mantra was that profit margins were the most mean reverting series in finance. And so that was what we talked about for a number of years. And then we saw profit margins high prior to the GFC. The GFC fixed that, but then the profit margins came right back. And so one of the things that we've done over the past several years is look at the concentration within industries, the oligopolies, the monopolies, and their impact on profit margins for the system as a whole. And it certainly appears from the data, as well as just kind of anecdotally, as you look around the world, that these oligopolies are more profitable, that they haven't had the government intervention or government regulation like you might expect. And so therefore the system as a whole can run at a higher profit margin relative to what we would have thought through history. And so I think that's true. We try and incorporate that into our forecasting methodology. That, however, doesn't take the profit margins, you know, from 6 to 7 in order to justify the current move. So it's partially explanatory, but not completely explanatory. The second part of your question is, you know, with respect to book value, and we've had concerns book values for my entire career at GMO. When I got there in 04, we had something called book proxy, which was basically kind of rebuilding book by adding retained earnings through the years. And so we didn't really use traditional book. We used this book proxy. And we used that for a number of years until all of the buybacks ended up distorting that measurement as well. And then over the past several years, we had another effort where we wanted to take into account the changing nature of a lot of these companies, and basically reflecting the fact that GAAP standards haven't kept up with the intangibles and the investment-like companies. And so we have rebuilt, we would basically take R&D and advertising off the income statement, recapitalize it onto the balance sheet, depreciate that through time, and then run it back through the income statement. We'll make some other adjustments for inflation and LIFO, FIFO. But we think that that gives a much better assessment for book value than using that those traditional metrics, which have gotten skewed because of intangibles as well as buybacks. And you can almost make sense of the world under this framework. This framework allows you to understand a company like Amazon, mm-hmm. where its PE is nominally 100 or 200, whatever it is, but you know that company is a lot more profitable than what that nominal PE would suggest, because they've been able to invest a ton and not take on debt. And so we don't have a ton of sympathy for traditional book value and some of the traditional value industries, because we feel like they really rely on some flawed metrics that we've worked pretty hard to try and address.
You know, when you talk about book value, we can go back to this whole value versus growth dichotomy, and I want to think about energy and financials in particular, because those are two places where those metrics, the book value metrics, actually still hold to a certain degree. Maybe you can talk to me about this dichotomy between growth and value, where you're saying that value is actually, there's an opportunity there, particularly right now during this whole reflation trade thing. Those are two sectors that are doing well.
Yeah, they've, they've been kind of left for dead, so to speak. And so, you know, we think that value, energy and financials are cheap. Financials have the benefit of being less levered than they have in the past. And so they can withstand more. And we've also seen, you know, energy stocks really being, you know, energy in the long term, as Jeremy's talked about, has some pretty big challenges to overcome. But unfortunately, we're not going to be able to wean ourselves off petrochemicals and carbon related sources of energy in the short run. And so there are some very cheap stocks, and particularly as the economy gets back going again, we think that those are two interesting areas that you can make a fair amount of money. But one of the things that we're most excited about with respect to value is that its cheapness is across the board. So we don't have to rely solely on fins or energy in order to generate returns. We can look at value relative to growth across all of those sectors, and value is cheap across the board.
And when you say value, it goes back to the question you said, how do we define value? Yeah, let's answer that question now. When you think about value versus growth, how are you defining value?
So, I mean, you can define it a bunch of different ways. So you can define it the traditional way with respect to book value, but you can also do a multi-price ratios, or the economic book, making those adjustments for book. Value is cheap on all of those metrics. You can sector neutralize it. You can do large cap. You can do small cap. You can make adjustments for industries that are more concentrated. You can adjust less concentrated industries. And no matter which way you slice and dice it, value is still incredibly cheap to what we've seen in history. And so we have skepticism that you can wring as much return out of traditional book as when you make some of these adjustments. But you do have the benefit of having a longer series of data. And value's trading, you know, at a 59% discount to where it trades historically. And that's pretty wide.
Right. You know, two takeaways that I have from this interview are that 60-40 is not necessarily going to hold you in good stead. And there are other alternatives to that. There are other asset classes to think about. And that, you know, when you think about value versus growth, that there are opportunities from an asset allocation perspective in value. One area that we haven't talked about here is the public versus the private market question. In terms of thinking about how you reform your asset allocation, I'm thinking principally about private equity and private markets. How are you guys thinking about the private markets versus the public markets?
Yeah, so we are public market investors, and so we are dilettantes with respect to private markets, but we do have what Jeremy calls the amateur's advantage, is that we can take look on the outside into that asset class to think about the sources for return. And as we've met institutional clients over the past 10 years, one of the things that we've been really impressed by and I've seen firsthand is the number of, in the past five to 10 years, a number of institutions that historically have not invested in private equity, moving into private equity as a panacea in terms of returns. And so now you have kind of, depending upon how you define it, $1.5 to $2 trillion of assets in private equity that are out there chasing deals. And so private equity arguably has delivered 400 basis points over public equity historically, but a lot of that sources of return occurred when you didn't have this massive amount of money in private equity chasing deals. And so what have you seen? You've seen the multiple that deals are taking place at increase. You're seeing the leverage levels increase in order to generate returns. You're seeing more and more retail investors moving into private equity. They're trying to get it into 401k plans. And so that all has the impact of limiting your returns. And even pretty sophisticated institutions, like you have to quiz them pretty hard in order for them to make the assumption that, yes, there's probably less return in private equity than we've seen historically. And sorry, going on a bit. The other thing is that private equity, the range of returns based on what manager you invest in is enormous. So skill in accessing and investing in the right private equity managers is enormously important relative to your potential outcome. And you know, this is not Lake Wobegon. We can't all be above average in that exercise. So we do have some skepticism for private equity. Not that it's all bad and that it's going to end in a flaming disaster, but you really need to make some questions with respect to the assumptions that you're making in terms of the returns, as well as your ability to access those top level managers that really probably provide more skepticism with respect to private equity than what I think you would see normally.
Right. You know, actually, interestingly enough, as you were saying that, it immediately made me think about, the faded lockdown, you know, mutant variant lockdown scenario. And the reason I'll tell you is this, because I was thinking to myself as we were going through the different asset classes before about what happens in those lockdown scenarios to spreads and also to liquidity, because what we've seen thus far, while interest rates have been going up since the beginning of the year, is that spreads actually haven't really been going up. Liquidity is still relatively there for the companies that are issuing this debt, both in high yield leveraged loans and potentially also these LBO operations. What happens, do you think, in sort of a more pernicious scenario, both in terms of liquidity and also in terms of spreads? Are those concerns, or am I being excessively worried?
No, I mean, I think the market has clearly or reasonably clearly made the assessment that things by summertime is going to be back to normal. And if the, you know, repricing comes when things change at the margin. And so if that gets repriced from this summer to this fall to, you know, Dr. Fauci was on the TV this weekend saying everybody's going to need to be wearing a mask in 2022. If that narrative starts to seep into the domain, well, then risk assets are going to be repriced. Now, you probably won't see high yield at 1100, but certainly for the spreads that we see today, they're discounting a pretty optimistic scenario. And, you know, it seems like everybody's tripping over themselves at this point to raise their GDP estimates for the year as well. And so it does feel as though that the mutant variant, which sounds awful, that scenario is really being discounted. But if you know, things change at the margin. If that's really not a summer thing, it's really in the fall where that herd immunity is coming to, or into 2022, then there's some air pockets between here and there.
Right, definitely. The last thing that we haven't talked about this whole time is precious metals. I'm not even going to go into Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. I don't want your inaugural time on Real Vision to be, does this guy think, what does he think about Bitcoin? But I want to talk to you about gold. And one of the reasons is because I know that in your piece in 2Q of 2020, you talked about gold. Where do you see gold as an asset class?
Yeah, so gold is something that we've really struggled with through the years. And we had Jim Grant from Grant's Interest Rate Observer into the office years ago. And I asked him, how do you value gold? And he responded as only Jim can. He said, gold is the value investor's indulgence. And he did a very nice job of sidestepping how you would put a valuation on gold. And what I'd heard Jeremy and Ben say for years is, I'll buy gold when it yields the same thing as a T-bill. And I think Buffett said something like that as well. And so actually in 08, Jeremy was walking by and I called him into my office and I, you know, I had the Bloomberg screen, BTMM, and I showed him the yields and gold was yielding more than a T-bill as the T-bill rates went negative. And so we did buy some gold in one of our hedge funds at the time, and we actually made a lot of money. And we realized we made a lot of money. We didn't quite know what to do. And so we ended up selling out of it. So we've really struggled to build a valuation framework for owning gold. But there is another way to think about it in terms of opportunity costs. And we got this from Inigo Fraser-Jenkins at AllianceBernstein. And he talks about the opportunity cost of gold. You know, gold has delivered, has maintained its purchasing power through several thousand years, which is really quite the feat if you think about an asset that doesn't yield anything. And so if you can think about, if you assume gold is going to deliver zero real, and you can think about that relative to negative real yielding fixed income assets, you can see gold as having a home in a portfolio. And so that becomes a little bit more of an opportunity cost discussion relative to the negative real yielding bonds. We've kind of gone a step further where we have allocated more to liquid alternatives over the past several years in lieu of holding bonds and gold, because we believe we can generate a positive real return through liquid alts.
I'm just thinking to myself, what have we missed? If I could have you wrap it up in terms of your overall thesis, what you want to get across to viewers, what would you say?
I guess ultimately, you know, in terms of our portfolios, there's value in lowering the duration of your portfolio. And you can do that a bunch of different ways. And you can do that actually in ways that increase your return and lower your risk. And so specifically on the equity side, tilting more towards value, we actually have a long value, short growth strategy where we think the returns are potentially asymmetric because value can only get so cheap. And we think growth has aspects of growth have a long way to fall. But also on the fixed income side, you know, decreasing your allocation to nominal duration, even though, you know, that duration has increased, those yields have increased. So there's more opportunity now than there was back in March, where you're really, you know, yields just got so low. But there are other segments from the fixed income market that we think have some opportunity in it as well, whether that be asset backs or allocating liquid alts, which are really, you know, an asset class that it has not delivered over the past several years. But there are things you can do. You just have to be comfortable with the fact that they haven't performed well, and therefore the opportunity set is better.
Excellent. Matt, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us. I think we made it to almost an hour. You know, in the middle, my power went out, but, you know, it's been a pleasure. And I hope to have another conversation with you on Real Vision again soon.
Thanks, Ed. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Welcome to the end of the video. We know that on average, 85% of you who start a video on Real Vision finish it. That's extraordinary. On Facebook, it would just be 4%. And that's because Real Vision creates the most engaging content in the entire media world. Let us help you grow your business by making video content that really engages your customers. Email us at customvideo@realvision.com.